Come on then, I'ma show them how to tell them the story again.
CKUT Radio 90.3 FM in Montreal.
From Cairo, Egypt, this is Democracy Now!
Really, even more frayed, even more diminished. I thought he looked shorter, actually. Not just thinner, but shorter. And he was, he was hurt in his forehead. He told us afterwards that he banged his head against the wall in a complete meltdown.
Ali Abdel Fattah has become one of the world's most prominent political prisoners. The British Egyptian citizen has spent most of the past decade locked up in Egypt. He recently ended a 7-month hunger strike. Today we spend the hour with his mother, Leila Swaib, and his sister, Sanaa Swaib.
The U.S. has stakes in that regime, stakes in that oppression, and so has responsibility. It's not leverage. Leverage is as if you're not a stakeholder in this. You are part of this, and you are a big part of this. You send $1.3 billion of military aid to Egypt every year.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from Cairo, Egypt. In Colorado, the gunman suspected of shooting and killing 5 people Saturday night at Club Q, an LGBTQ plus nightclub in Colorado Springs, has been indicted for murder and hate crimes. Officials have identified the 5 victims as Daniel Davis Aston, a 28-year-old trans man who moved from Tulsa, Oklahoma 2 years ago and worked as a bartender and entertainer at Club Q. Kelly Loving, a 40-year-old trans woman who had recently moved to Denver and whose sister described her as loving, caring, and sweet. 38-year-old Derek Rump, a Club Q bartender whose mother described her as a kind, loving person who had a heart of gold. 35-year-old Ashley Paw, who leaves behind an 11-year-old daughter devastated by the loss of her mother. And 22-year-old Raymond Green Vance. Richard Fierro, a retired military veteran, has been identified as the person who confronted and disarmed the shooter. Fierro was at Club Q to watch a drag show with his wife, his daughter, and Raymond Green Vance, who was his daughter's boyfriend.
I want those 5 families to know that's all I care about. I want those that are in the hospital right now, get better. Please get better. We went out to see a show and have a good time. And thank God Raymond was smiling and was dancing with my kid. And my daughter got to spend the last day with him.
Richard Fierro was deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan 4 times and said in an interview with the New York Times, the experience still haunts him. He left the Army in 2013 due to the brutal psychological and physical toll of war and said he never thought he'd experience the same violence at home. In Pennsylvania, immigrant rights advocates welcomed a second bus of asylum seekers to Philadelphia Monday morning, sent by Texas Republican Governor Greg Abbott. Abbott says Texas has bused a total of over 13,000 asylum seekers to sanctuary cities, including Washington, D.C. and New York. Since Abbott was reelected in November, he's intensified his hate speech against immigrants, recently comparing the arrival of thousands of asylum seekers at the U.S.-Mexico border to an invasion. It's the same term used repeatedly by the white supremacist gunman charged with killing 23 people at a Walmart store in El Paso, Texas, in 2019, the deadliest attack on the Latinx community in modern U.S. history. The CEO of one of Ukraine's largest power companies has asked people to stock up on warm clothing and blankets, warning Russia's assault on Ukraine's power grid will lead to rolling blackouts throughout the winter. On Monday, the World Health Organization's regional director for Europe, Dr. Hans Kluge, said Ukraine now faces its darkest days of the war so far.
This winter will be life-threatening for millions of people in Ukraine. Half of Ukraine's energy infrastructure is either damaged or destroyed. This is already having knock-on effects on the health system and on the people's health. Put simply, this winter will be about survival.
U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris met with Philippines President Ferdinand Marcos Jr. in Manila Monday, where she vowed the U.S. would expand its military presence in the Philippines. Her meeting comes amidst growing tensions between the U.S. and China over the status of Taiwan, and as China and the Philippines square off over disputed islands in the South China Sea.
An armed attack on the Philippines, armed forces, public vessels, or aircraft in the South China Sea would invoke U.S. mutual defense commitments. And that is an unwavering commitment that we have to the Philippines.
Dozens of protesters gathered near the presidential palace in Manila denouncing Vice President Harris's visit and U.S. intervention in the Philippines.
We also are against the warmongering of the United States for the sake of asserting its hegemony in this part of the world. We don't want our country to be used as the springboard or launching pad of the wars of the United States against China or any other country. We want a peaceful Philippines and a peaceful region.
In Indonesia, the death toll from Monday's powerful earthquake in West Java province has soared to over 260 people. More than 1,000 were injured. Dozens more remain missing as rescuers continue to search for survivors in the rubble of collapsed buildings. Many of the victims are school children. In China, at least 38 people were killed Monday after a fire swept through a two-story factory in central Henan province that housed chemicals and other industrial goods. Local officials said the fire began after welders allowed sparks to fall on cotton fabric, causing it to ignite. According to the Hong Kong-based China Labor Bulletin, an average of 75 Chinese workers died of workplace-related deaths each day in 2020. In more labor news, members of a union representing U.S. freight rail conductors have voted to reject a tentative labor contract. It's the fourth and largest of a dozen rail industry unions to reject the agreement brokered by the Biden administration last September. Many of those rejecting the deal said the tentative contract failed to address chronic staffing shortages, long hours, unpredictable schedules. If any of the unions decides to strike, others will honor their picket lines, setting up a potential nationwide strike by more than 100,000 workers as soon is December 9th. Jeremy Ferguson, president of the International Association of Sheet, Metal, Air, Rail, and Transportation Workers, said railroad executives can avert a strike by returning to the table to bargain in good faith.
It was profits above all else. Every quarter, they wanted to lower their operating ratios so they could please Wall Street. And they did not worry about pleasing their employees. I think a day of reckoning is coming that they are going to have to realize one way or another that they have to treat their employees with respect.
In Alabama, Governor Kay Ivey has issued a sweeping order to pause all executions statewide and ordered a review of Alabama's capital punishment system after a series of botched attempts to deliver lethal injections in at least three executions this year. Just last week, Alabama called off the killing of Kenneth Eugene Smith after officials struggled to establish an IV line for his lethal injection. Alabama canceled another execution in September for the same reason. Meanwhile, in Missouri, a 19-year-old teenager is urging a federal court to allow her to attend her father's execution next week. Corianza Ramey is the daughter of Kevin Johnson, who's scheduled to die by lethal injection November 29th after several attempts to halt his death sentence were denied. A Missouri law bans people under the age of 21 from being present at an execution. In a statement, Ramey said, quote, "If my father were dying in the hospital, I would sit by his bed holding his hand and praying for him until his death, both as a source of support for him and as a support for me as a necessary part of my grieving process and for my peace of mind, she said. Oregon's outgoing governor has pardoned 45,000 people convicted of simple possession of marijuana. Democratic Governor Kate Brown also said Monday she would void more than $14 million in associated fines and fees. Recreational cannabis use has been legal in Oregon since 2016. In a statement, Brown said, quote, Oregonians should never face housing insecurity, employment barriers, and educational obstacles as a result of doing something that is now completely legal and has been for years, she said. And human rights groups are denouncing the International Soccer Federation, FIFA, for ordering a ban on any display of support for LGBTQ plus rights by players during the World Cup in Qatar. On Monday, FIFA said it would issue yellow cards to any players displaying rainbow-colored armbands in support of the One Love anti-discrimination campaign. The head of Germany's Soccer Association joined players, coaches and fans in denouncing FIFA's decision.
FIFA has today prohibited a statement in favor of diversity and human rights. These are values to which it commits itself in its own statutes. This is more than frustrating from our point of view, and also an unprecedented event in the history of the World Cup, I believe.
Meanwhile, Iran's national soccer team refused to sing the Iranian national anthem ahead of its opening match against England Monday in a silent gesture of solidarity with anti-government protesters in Iran. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're in downtown Cairo, Egypt. The Nile River flows behind me. Today, we spend the hour bringing you an interview I did this weekend after we flew into Cairo from Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, where we covered the UN climate summit. We're in Cairo, Egypt, in the apartment of Leila Swaif. She is mother of Ala Abdel Fattah, who is in prison in Egypt for most of the last decade. We are joined right now by Leila Swaif, who is a math professor at Cairo University, and her daughter, Ala's sister, Sana Saif. They just recently visited Ala in prison. They hadn't seen him for a number of weeks. He's just finished a seven-month hunger fast. The last days of that fast, he stopped drinking water during COP27, the UN climate summit here in Sharm el-Sheikh, not far from here in Egypt. I wanted to start by asking you both about your visit. You came out of it shaken, seeing Ala for the first time in quite some time, sitting behind glass as he spoke to you faintly through a phone. Talk about what he told you.
The visit happened in a glass cabin, like it always happens, which was disappointing. I had hoped, that it wouldn't be like that. Ala looked even more thin and more weak than the last. The last time I saw him was before this visit was on the 24th of October, so it had been over 3 weeks. He looked really even more frail, even more diminished. I thought he looked shorter, just thinner, but shorter. And he was hurt in his forehead. He told us afterwards that he'd banged his head against the wall in a complete meltdown and tantrum and so on. So that's how it was. Now, because the business was in a closed cabin, you talk to him through a phone, so only one person could talk to him at a time. So Sana got most of the visit. She's the one who took to him. I was just looking, seeing him gesticulating, and that's it.
Yeah, he recounted what had happened. On Tuesday, he had a meltdown.
He stopped drinking water on Sunday. So you get the context. He stopped his 100 calories a week before that, on the 1st of November, on Sunday, on the first day of COP, on Sunday the 6th. On the first day of COP, he stopped drinking water. And then on Tuesday, today, when he'd already not been drinking water at all for 2 days, then I can tell you what happened.
They wanted to do a medical checkup for all the cell, for all the inmates. They were reluctant to put on record Ale's hunger strike or his water strike. And so they were taking to the medical facility, and he insisted on putting his water strike and hunger strike on record and admitting him to the medical facility. So the officer started telling him that he's not cooperating, that he's refusing to do a medical checkup. He said, "I'm not refusing. I just want my hunger strike and my water strike to be put on record." And then they got a new officer that he didn't know, and he started dealing with him roughly, like aggressively, talking to him aggressively. And so he snapped, he lost it. And he said, "I'm not leaving the medical facility." So they got a riot force to carry him forcibly back to his cell. This is a man who has stopped water for 3 days. And so while they were carrying him back to his cell, he said, "I lost it. I don't know what happened, but I just kept saying, 'I promise I'll do something to myself. I will hurt myself if I'm not admitted, if my hunger strike is not put on record.'" And so when they put him back to his cell, he banged his head to the wall until it bled. This incident happened on the 8th, and then on the 11th, on Friday, he had calmed down. He was taking a shower and he collapsed in the bathroom, and that's when he fainted. And they did a medical intervention in the cell. Like, they took him in outside of the bathroom, and the personnel entered the cell, and they made a medical intervention in the cell. And he woke up. He was put on IVs on a salt solution. It's called Ringer, and glucose. He started waking up, but he was still unable to move, and they would put honey in his mouth, and that's how they brought him back to life. So what happened on Friday, what happened on Tuesday was a meltdown. What happened on Friday was a near-death experience. And he elaborated a lot on how this felt and how, and when he was telling me, he was really stuck on that moment. He kept saying that, "I was relieved, and I got shocked later how much I was relieved that this whole thing is over." And then I started doubting whether I'm doing this to resist. Am I fighting really for life, or am I just tired and I want to be spared of this? A good part of the visit was on this elaboration of him, talking about how much he felt relief by this near-death experience. So he decided to take a break from the hunger strike, and he stopped. He started taking food, and he wrote us this letter saying, "Come and I want to celebrate my birthday with you." And he, in the visit, he was saying, I wanted to stop it and decide whether I go back to my hunger strike or not. But after the discussion we had, and after seeing his psychological state, my advice to him was no. Apparently you're unstable and you're very vulnerable right now, and it's the important thing is to keep your sanity and to keep you better.
Did he agree with you?
Yes. He trusts our advice and judgment.
Yes, and of course, and Kamen, it made a difference to him that he heard for the first time about all that's being done for him, and about what happened in Coop, and because he had been completely isolated. I mean, that's part of the point of keeping him from having the radio, keeping him from seeing the newspapers, even government newspapers, because you can usually guess what's happening, even if they put their own take on it. So, this insistence on not allowing him a radio, not allowing him newspapers. It is deliberate to isolate him so that he doesn't know what is actually happening, except when he sees us on visits. So for him, this was all news. Yani, all that had happened, all that Sana had done, all that Mona had done, all the messages of solidarity I had gotten, all this was news to Alan.
Yeah, it was beyond his imagination that there was a fight out there for his freedom. Like, he was, his scope, his horizon was like on a music player and the radio and finding a way to cling back to life. Like, we were on totally different frequencies. He's talking from this very dark place, and I'm telling him that we're going to get you out. There is a big fight of getting you out. We're going to get you out. And so that, of course, it shocked him. It was a surprise to him, but it also gave him some strength.
Sano, you have accomplished, inside and outside of Egypt, galvanizing support for Alaa and other political prisoners, holding a sit-in in Britain with your sister Mona in front of the Foreign Ministry office. Also, in the United States, I saw you as you spoke to grassroots groups, as you spoke to congressional leaders, talking also about Alaa's book, You Will Not Yet Be Defeated, because he's in prison and can't do it himself. And then in COP27, really being the spearhead of a movement that is bringing together the issue of climate justice and human rights, did you ever imagine that you could have this effect?
No, I never imagined. Of course, I was planning to try and use the conference to get some attention on my brother and on the human rights situation in Egypt. But I never imagined that I would be so beautifully adopted by the climate movement, and that they would empower us. It was overwhelming and really heartwarming, and I never imagined the scale of media attention or the solidarity that we've seen.
When you spoke to Alaa and you talked about the kind of global support that he's getting, his statement, any form of political organizing that may solve our global crises has to stem from personal solidarity like this. How did he say this to you through the glass, through that partition?
So that was after he recounted what happened to him. We started telling him about the campaign. So it was starting to hit him. And then I gave the speaker to my aunt so she can also recount to him. So it's not just me. Like, everybody's telling you it's really big. And that's when I think I saw it in his face. Like, it was starting to hit him that there is a world outside of this very dark place he's in right now. And that's when he said this one sentence. Like a part of him, this intellectual, political part, for a second got awakened, a glimpse of it. But before the visit ended, it became shut again. He closed on again to this very dark place he's in right now. But I'm glad this part of his character exists and is present, and he just needs to get out of prison for it to really flourish.
Is Alaa planning to go back on a hunger strike?
Alaa, in the visit, he was telling me, should I go back tomorrow? I said, no, wait. I gave him a date. I'm not going to say that date publicly, but I know they know the date. I told him, your body needs a rest, but if this date comes without me telling you otherwise, then you go on hunger strike. So there is a date set between me and Alaa and the Egyptian authorities.
Sana Saif and Leila Swaif, the sister and mother of political prisoner Alaa Abd El Fattah, will be back with them in 30 seconds.
So you think you could tell skies from pain? Can you tell a green
is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We continue now with my interview here in Cairo, Egypt, this weekend with Leila Swaif and Sena Saif, the mother and sister of the British-Egyptian political prisoner, Ala Abdel Fattah.
Let me ask you about what you did in Britain. Before COP, you and your sister Mona had this sit-in day and night in front of the British Foreign Ministry through the end of the Prime Minister Truss to Rishi Sunak. What was the response in Britain? And explain what you're demanding. Of course, you, your sister Mona, and Allah himself are British Egyptian citizens.
The same consular access and bring him to London, bring him home to London. The British government is very clear that Ala is a British citizen. Yeah. What we hold them, what we're very disappointed with is that they're accepting the Egyptian narrative of not acknowledging his dual nationality.
What kind of response did you get to your sit-in?
So I sat outside the Foreign Office for 20 days. This is when we started seeing a new level of solidarity from people I did not expect. And so it was, I thought I would be like very lonely. I don't know a lot of people in London, but it was very heartwarming, the amount of solidarity I saw. We started getting attention from politicians. I got attention from MPs. A lot of MPs visited me, and our MP, David Lammy, came the first day. But we started getting attention from the government near the end, right before COP, when we got a phone call from the Foreign Secretary, James Cleverly, and then I got this letter as a response from the Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak.
After you came out of the prison where you saw Ala, you didn't go first to the British government to tell them what had happened. You went directly to the media. Why, Sana?
I was really, really angry and disappointed that while Ala was enduring all of this horrible experience, this was happening at the same time while governments were getting assurances that Ala's health will be preserved. So I was really angry at all of the backdoor promises and I felt like I've been going about it the wrong way, believing in those promises. And this time, these are not promises that were made in the dark. Like, these are not promises that were made privately. President Macron of France said that Sisi told him that he commits to preserving Ala's health on Monday, and on that same day, or on Sunday, and on the second day and day after, a unit dealt with Ala forcibly. So I was feeling really angry, and I lost faith in that process, in that kind of process.
Leila, tell us about your son, Ala.
Ala, in particular, there is a special bond between us, because for 4 years, for 5 years, his father was in jail, and before Mona was born, he was. And it was me and Ala in France with me doing my PhD, with Saif in jail. Even when Mona was born, Mona was the baby, you know. He was the older brother. He was the one who was helping me. I was just remembering today, actually, there was this day in England, in France, where I had this horrible cold and I was very ill and I overslept and I woke up terrified because, you know, I overslept with a five-year-old child and a six-month-old baby in the house with nobody to feed them or change. And I didn't understand why Mona hadn't cried out. I got up, and Ala had gotten up, taken care of Mona. He was six or five or something, and changed her, was playing with her very nicely and quietly. I said, "Wow, why didn't you wake me?" And he said, "Mama, you were sick." And for me, that's Allah. He was always, because he was, because he was older, and because we'd been alone together when his father was in jail, there was a very special bond, a very special bond.
You were alone taking care of your two children, Ala and your six-month-old baby, Mona, because your husband, Ahmed Saif, was in prison.
At that time, he was a communist, and he continued to be a communist in conviction. But at that time, he was part of a communist organization, actually. And he was arrested and tortured, and confessions obtained from him, and finally sentenced to 5 years. It was a bit like Alan's trial, in that they came out on bail, and then were tried when they were out, and then they were arrested again, and so on. So that's how we got Mona. Mona was born while her father was in jail. So now it was the one we got after he came out, the one we celebrated with. When we got Sanaa, and he was 12 years old, so for him she was, somewhere in between a sister and a daughter.
Talk about that, Sanaa. How Ala was not just your big brother, but also a father figure to you, 12 years older.
Yeah, he was like, we're friends. We have a very similar taste in music and in art. But also because of the age difference and because of that dynamic, he was also like a mentor to me. He's my always my biggest champion. I was this bohemian child who changed her mind about what I want to do with life every month, probably. But he was always like very excited to the new idea or project. So I want sculpting. So he would like research and find a place, and we go, and I learn sculpting for a while. Then I like pandas, and I want to be a vet. And then he goes and devotes also a lot of time and research into let's study pandas and painting until I settled on filmmaking. And by the time I settled on filmmaking, nobody had believed me. Like, of course, you just wait it out, sleep on it, honey. But Hale was like, no. He was very excited. And I settled on filmmaking, really. And my first laptop where I used for editing, Ale was the one who got it. I mean, of course, he asked you all to pitch in, but this was his project. My first ever filmmaking workshop. My first set was his friends. He had friends who worked in filmmaking, and they took me with them so I can see a film set.
Sanaa, as a filmmaker, you helped Jahanu Jain make The Square, the Oscar-nominated documentary about the uprising at Tahrir Square.
Yeah, I was very resistant to the family. I didn't want to be in politics like the rest of my family. I was, 2011 got me. So I was, before 2011, I was very disinterested. I didn't want to know anything about their political activism, and it wasn't the only thing in life, like, right? It was part of their identity, but it wasn't the dominating part. But 2011 really inspired me. I was 17, and it was I went to the first demonstration by coincidence, but then it was really inspiring to me and to my whole generation, really.
Sanaa, when did you first go to prison? You have been in prison for more than 3 years.
2014.
3 years CC. After.
Yeah.
The Arab Spring.
Yeah. It was during Sisi, of course. I was part of a demonstration that was calling for the release of political prisoners, and it's anti-dem. There was this new demonstration law, anti-protest law, and so I was part of it, and I got arrested. My main motivation then was really personal. It was obvious that the revolution was defeated, and I think if it wasn't for my brother being in prison, I would have tried to step out of that, to just go back to my normal life. But my Alec was in prison, and so I was advocating for political prisoners. And that's how I got arrested, and I was sentenced to 2 years. But then I got pardoned. I got a presidential pardon after a year and 3 months.
You have gone on hunger strike. Can you describe how it feels, the stages you go through?
I was on hunger strike. I went on hunger strike only once for 72 days. It wasn't partial. It was a full strike. Like, I didn't take any
water and salt.
Yeah. What happens is that by the fifth day, you stop feeling hungry. Like, you don't actually feel, you don't starve. Somehow the body understands that it's not going to get food. But there are phases. It starts, so the body needs energy. So it starts by breaking the extra fat, using the extra fat to get energy. After that, after it's done with extra fat, it gets into break muscles to get energy, and that's a very painful phase. After the breaking of the muscles, it resorts to important fats. These are fats that are keeping the organs together, that are in between organs, and these are like the fats that are behind the eyes. That's why I was really shocked when I saw Ale in August, because his eyes looked sunken. And I remember when I did my research before my hunger strike, that means we're at a very critical phase. By day 70, I think by the end, they did make a medical intervention. I had already my blood pressure was very low, so I would take salt solutions, salt sachets. So it wasn't enough. So I accepted a cannula, and I accepted salt. I did not accept glucose. So I had a cannula. IVs. So by the end of it, I had fainted or something had happened. I woke up, I found that I'm put on glucose. But the way they did it was much softer than how my brother explains, like what I heard from Ale. I was in a hospital. The people who were dealing with me were doctors. They weren't civilians. They were police doctors, but they were doctors, not guards. I wasn't in my cell.
This is so painful to raise, but you and Ala were in prison when your father Ahmed Saif died.
It's a horrible news. You hear it anywhere. It was a shock. Like, I don't think it would have been easier to grasp if I was outside of prison. It's just the loneliness of living this on your own, not with your family, and knowing that they are also lonely, knowing that Mama and my sister, they don't have us around them. I dealt with it with denial at first, and when you lose your father, that's horrible news to hear anywhere. But later I became angry because I realized, I recalled his last visit, and I recalled, and I started, he wasn't that sick, right? He became more sick, his heart became more sick when I was arrested and when he attended my trial. And that's when I was really fueled with anger. I did not realize the scale of the viciousness against my family until my father's funeral. When I after the funeral, so both of us, me and Ale, we attended the funeral as inmates.
Leila, can you talk about your husband's life and what did it mean to him at the end of his life that two of his three children, Sana and Ala, were both in prison?
First, I want to highlight how different prisons at that time were from prisons now. Because it highlights the difference between
a regime which is repressive and corrupt and everything, but is rational, and a regime which has gone mad. During the Mubarak era, once they tortured you and got what they wanted from you, they left you alone to manage your okay, you're imprisoned, but you could study, you could, you know, do whatever. Yeah. So he studied law. He finished his law degree just a few months before being released. And his idea was mainly to be a lawyer and to do some pro bono human rights work. And then the pro bono human rights work took over his life until he wasn't doing anything else and wasn't earning any money because it was pro bono. And everyone started telling him, just come and work with us because we need you and we need you and we want you to be. And he became this amazing human rights lawyer who was really, really, really very clear about and focused on human rights. So that was safe.
Leila, what did it mean to your husband at the end of his life that two of his three children were not with him?
Yeah. He even talked about that. He said, there's this famous quote of safe saying, "I'm sorry, my son, that instead of my heritage being a more free and democratic society, my heritage is that it's the same cell that I was in should see you in it."
Now let's talk about the next generation, about Alice and Khaled. He's almost 11. He's nonverbal. Can you talk about the day in 2013 when Ala was arrested at home?
So after the raid, after they forcibly took Ala from, we weren't sure whether Khaled was on the other side of the house. So the police forces entered to the bedroom where Ala and his wife were, and Khaled was in his room.
So he was like two.
He was two. Yes, he was two. Yeah. We weren't sure. He seemed asleep. His mom, after the police left, his mom ran to Khaled, and Khaled seemed asleep. But we weren't sure whether he was aware and just faking sleep or not. Afterwards, Khaled was diagnosed with that he's on the spectrum, and for a while, we weren't sure whether this is a trauma or whether he's actually on the spectrum. Why is he nonverbal? With time, it was settled that he's on the spectrum, he's nonverbal, and there was a trauma, but that's something else. But Khaled has never had a stable life. Kids generally need a stable life, but kids on the spectrum, kids with autism, need a stable life. And we've tried everything. Like, it doesn't work without his father being in his life. He's really, really attached to his father, although they haven't spent a lot of time together. So when Khaled all of a sudden is not allowed to visit Ali, he gets really, really, he acts out and he gets angry and he expresses that. And it's very hard to have anything stable for Khaled because, you know, we negotiate some sort of way to get Khaled to visit his father, but then they change the rules, or they decide that visits are behind the glass shield, or Ali is now in a facility, was in a facility where he got tortured, and his torture is present during the visit, so you can't have a kid present. With things that horrible and that epic happen, and we have to change Khaled's routine, and it's very obvious that he's attached to his father, and he's really angry that the system keeps changing. When Ale was briefly released in 2019, Alec finished his 5-year sentence and he was released for 6 months. And then he was rearrested. Although Alec was on probation, so he had to present himself to the police station from 6 p.m. to 6 a.m., but he still had half of the day of freedom, from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. That brief period really mattered with Khaled. They built a new beautiful relationship, and even all of the people who work, the professionals who work on Khaled's case, such as the speech therapist and psychologist, all of them noticed. It's not just us, the family, or his mom. All of them said that there has been great improvement. This really has... It really matters to the kid to have his father. He's really attached to his father, and he needs his father. And Ale is a very patient, kind father who...
Imaginative,
who reads, who likes to do research. So whenever he had access to books, he read a lot and studied a lot about autism and what's best to do. A lot of our letters are about that. So... the brief time when Alec was out, it was a great time for Khaled. But right now, it's even much worse because he finally had this strong relationship with his father, and this was taken from him.
Sana Saif and Leila Swaif, the sister and mother of Egyptian political prisoner Alaa Abd El Fattah. We'll come back to them in 20 seconds. Kindred Lament by Steel Pulse. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in Cairo, Egypt, as we return to my interview with Leila Swaif and Sana Saif, the mother and sister of the British-Egyptian political prisoner Alaa Abd El Fattah. I asked Sana about Alaa's most recent trial when he was sentenced to 5 years in prison last December, and whether they were ever allowed to see the evidence brought against him.
The lawyers were never allowed to see to access to the case files. The lawyers were never allowed to make a case, and the prosecution never made a case. The judge just gave the sentence like that. We only know two facts about this case. We only have one. Yeah, we only know two things about this case. The first thing we know is that the only piece of evidence is this Facebook post that he shared about a prisoner dying of torture in Egyptian prisons.
It was someone else's Facebook post that he
yes, he we shared it. And the Facebook post mentioned an officer who tortured a certain prisoner who died. Alec was arrested and kept under the authority of this same officer. This is the officer that, not that tortured him himself, but that supervised his torture. His name is Ahmed Fikri. This is the pseudonym, and Walid Dahshan is the real name. And this man continues to work in... Alec now is transferred from the facility where this man is. But we've made several complaints against this man and saying that there is a vendetta. There is clearly a vendetta because it's in the case files. It's not just because we're claiming there is a vendetta. And nothing. The other thing we know, we saw by coincidence, by luck, a piece of paper that says... When is his release date? And his release date is in 2027. Alec was arrested in 2019. He was sentenced to 5 years. That's what we all heard in court. But his release date is 2027. Why? Because they decided that the 2.5 years he spent in pretrial detention are not to be counted in. It's pointless to talk about the legal procedure, really, if each step of it is a sham.
How many years of the last decade has Alaa been in prison?
Nine.
9 of the last 10 years?
Yeah, 9 of the last 10 years.
Now with world leaders calling for Ale's release, what gives you hope?
The fact that that all of these, this injustice is not happening in a corner hidden somewhere, that finally there is a spotlight on it. I'm not very, very hopeful because I'm worried that COP has ended, the cameras will leave. Also, Ale's hunger strike is broken, so that means the urgency that maybe the British government maybe have felt, if they have felt urgency, will be will fade a little bit. But yet still, we had, there was a spotlight, worldwide spotlight on the on this extreme injustice, and that gives me hope not only for Ale but for the rest of the political prisoners and the human rights situation in Egypt.
Your estimate of how many political prisoners there are in Egypt?
The estimate is 65,000. The estimate that most of like the proper human rights organizations have done. From my experience, from what I saw, there is no way to give a proper estimate. Even if the Egyptian authorities themselves wanted to have an estimate, they wouldn't be able to do to get a proper estimate, because especially my last arrest in 2019, I noticed things have become really hectic on the ground. They have lost control. You have several agencies that arrest. Many of those have facilities, jails that do not exist on paper, and so national security has its own jails, and these are not prisons, these are not official prisons, and so prisoners are not admitted. I was in an official prison. I was in a place where I knew that I have a number, a code, a record. I am on record. There is a paper trail behind me, and so I exist. But even in the facility I was in, there were people who didn't exist on paper, officers and inmates. One of the girls, the girls that were arrested from Sinai, she had a baby. She went into labor in prison, so she did not exist on paper, and her baby did not exist on paper. And seeing the scale of this madness, it has escalated starting 2019. That's why I say I cannot believe any estimate, because we will never really know the number until the doors are open. I don't think the authorities themselves are capable of knowing the number. The machine has become so monstrous and so hectic that it's hard to track.
The U.S., you have met with who? And how high up did the demands go? I mean, Biden has come to Egypt, has met with Sisi. We saw the pictures of them laughing.
In Sharm, I met with Pelosi, with Nancy Pelosi, and with Samantha Power, who is the head of USAID. Before that, when I traveled to D.C., I had meetings with people from State Department, a lot of members of Congress, and in Senate. I also met with some members of the Senate in Sharm. I don't know. I made appeals to President Biden. I don't know what happened really on the ground. I made appeals, and I know the appeals reached the president. I know the appeals reached the White House. I don't know what happened when they met. And what I know is that during the time President Biden was here in Egypt, this is when Ale had his near-death experience, right? That was on Friday. That's what I know. So that does not give me a lot of hope. Of course, if President Biden has pushed for the case strongly, then Ale would be out shortly, would be out soon.
Do you think the U.S. has that much power?
Absolutely. I don't just think, I know. I know the U.S. has that much power. We've seen, look, when I traveled to the U.S., a lot of those politicians and those, and even like aides in Congress offices would tell me, we don't have that much leverage. You don't understand. there was a vicious campaign against me being a foreign spy and espionage. And I was being harassed in Sharm el-Sheikh, like even physically, people following me and showing themselves to me that they are following me.
You mean these are Egyptians?
Egyptians, okay. The day the American administration appeared, all of these people just disappeared as if you clicked on a button. The state media narrative all of a sudden changed, and they started, instead of saying that that Ale's sister is a spy and that we're not going to be forced by the West, things like that, all of a sudden they started talking about how Ale's sister applied for a pardon, and poor thing, he has a kid on the spectrum. This is really devastating. The U.S. does not only have leverage. Leverage is a bad way of putting it. The U.S. has stakes in that regime, stakes in that oppression, and so has responsibility. It's not leverage. Leverage is as if you're not a stakeholder in this. You are part of this, and you are a big part of this. You send $1.3 billion of military aid to Egypt every year. And
You train their police officers. You train their army officers. They are so the whole military and police apparatus is so dependent on cooperation with the U.S. So dependent. It's not just the money. I mean, the money, Taban, is important, but money and bigger money comes from the Gulf and so on. But it's this whole operation is a U.S. operation. The helicopters they use to track people in the desert. This is a U.S. This whole CC thing is a U.S. security operation. But it really, yes, the U.S. can decide if they want to, that they want the regime to do this and not do that, I think.
It doesn't make sense that the U.S., the way the U.S. engages with Sisi's regime, it's in everybody's interest that Egypt stays a stable country, yet this regime is making the country deeply unstable. The way the U.S. is the way the U.S. is engaging its foreign policy in the region is very, very stupid. It's not wise, and it's not even within the interests of the U.S.
The name of Ale's book, of his writings, is "You Have Not Yet Been Defeated." Do you think Ale has been defeated?
It depends on what level of defeat. And certainly, I personally think that the 2011 revolution and its generation have been defeated. On a personal level, Ale has not been defeated. That's one. And when we talked about they're making an example of Ale, that's probably their main concern now. You make an example of someone, and then you have to release him without having broken him. That is very, very hard.
You're asking that Ale be released and deported to Britain?
Either he's released and he travels to Britain, or he be deported to Britain. I want him safe and out of the country.
That's Leila Swaif and Sanese, the mother and sister of the political prisoner Ale Abdel Fattah. I interviewed them in their family home here in Cairo, Egypt, this weekend. And that does it for this show. Special thanks to Sharif Abdelkaddous, Hani Massoud, Dennis Moynihan, and Nermeen Sheikh here in Cairo. And to Mike Burke, Charina Nadura, Robbie Karen, and Julie Crosby in New York. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Maria Terracena, Tammy Warrenoff, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, yo, what up? It's Tester Man from Tester Logic. You're listening to my favorite radio station, CKUT, 90.3 FM in Montreal.
Pick up the tree, decorate the tree, make a gift list, invite the in-laws, drop off the canned goods, find that fruitcake recipe for the office party, plan the dinner for Christmas Eve, decorate the house, hang the stockings, wrap the presents, ask Lucas to clean up his room, do the groceries, bake cookies. Right. Go get vaccinated.
The holidays are fast approaching. Get vaccinated against COVID-19 now so you'll be protected in time. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
The following is a previously broadcast program.
Why put us under pressure? Why can we live without the pleasure of loving who we love? Our love is just enough. Why do we live with the judgment? Why do we suffer all your comments when love is all we want? Free to love who we want. You'll never take our freedom. Try, but we'll fight until we bleed out. We know we don't belong, but we stand just as strong. Why do you think it means something to me? Why, when it never was about me? I've heard it all before. I never